Some time ago, and actually in the summer, when we were planning the lecture program, my department was kind enough to consult me on what we should do on March 4th for a speaker. And their requirements were rather severe. It should be a person who could talk to us about sea control and missions of the Navy and things that we've been discussing from a rather different and exciting, stimulating point of view. It should be someone who was a very good speaker and someone who probably had a new joke or two. So I thought about that, and of course I had a different requirement, and that was someone that I would like to spend my birthday with. So both of these requirements led to one terribly obvious choice, which was Dr. Nicholas Shadrin, whom I've known for 15 years. Nick has not always been a doctor. He started out as a naval officer, and for that reason is to us particularly interesting. We've talked so much recently about perception, and you've read, I hope, in your lessons and homework, how some people are charging that even in strategic arms talks, that our side asks the questions for the Soviets because they don't ask them, and then we go ahead and answer them as well. Well, when we're talking about perceptions, I have to say that a lot of us who are talking about Soviet perceptions are very ready to get up and tell you how Soviets feel, which is somewhat the same kind of thing. So it seemed terribly worthwhile and very exciting to have someone who did grow up in Russia, who is a Soviet perceptionist himself, to come and talk to us about how Soviets look at the Navy, look at missions of the Navy, look at our Navy, look at the professionalism of our officers. Nick grew up in almost a naval family in Leningrad, and he went through the entire naval school system, starting with the what became the Frunze School. In other words, in grammar school and high school, he was a naval cadet. He lived through the 900-day siege of Leningrad in the Second World War, and later graduated as a naval officer. He had a very distinguished career in the Soviet Union. He went to a higher naval school, somewhat comparable to the Naval War College. He commanded a destroyer escort and later a squadron of destroyers. And he saw some foreign duty, which was when he was based in Poland, in Gdansk, Gdynia. However, in his personal life, things developed that made it necessary for him to choose another way of life, and we're very fortunate that he chose to come to America, where he added greatly to our knowledge and perception of Soviet military education and thought. Nick is a person whom you will shortly see, is clearly dynamic. He was distinguished as a naval officer and was featured in Red Star as the outstanding commander of the year. But as soon as he got to the United States, he also became distinguished as a student and scholar, first doing a master's degree in operations analysis, and then going on to get his doctorate in political science, and wrote a dissertation on the Soviet Navy, which is an extremely important document, and one which I hold and will be happy to share with you for your research project. Nick will talk to you about the ideas and missions of the Navy, and then he will entertain questions, which you must be very free to give, and I think altogether we'll have an extremely stimulating time. So, without further ado.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. After such introduction, I was ready to run away. No, I will not able to fulfill one-tenth of expectations, probably, which were built in your mind by Captain Batten. For the second time in a row, I am being asked to discuss missions of the Soviet Navy. And I should admit that it's an extremely difficult problem, because I myself am not sure, first, that they know what missions of their Navy are, or those missions are formulated in the such precision as is being done in the United States Navy. Nonetheless, let me start with one document which was released in April of 1974 by Office of the Chief of Naval Operations and entitled Understanding Soviet Naval Development. According to that document, there are missions, quote, similar to those of the United States Navy. And those missions of the Soviet Navy are as follows. I remind you, nuclear strike / deterrence. Second, sea control and denial. Third, presence. And seaborne projection. Well, I believe I would complete my mission if I would put point here, because it's a quite authoritative document, as I said. And but, however, I disagree with such division. I would say not only oversimplified, but erroneously equated with those missions of United States Navy. And we're supposed to speak about Soviet Navy. First of all, I have a serious doubt that the presence itself, really, always gain influence for those who are present. I am not so sure about the utility of simple presence. We know from numerous examples that quite often presence produce reverse, undesirable results. So just to say the presence is not enough, you have to be present in a certain composition with certain power and with certain function, clearly defined. Also, speaking about the Soviet Union, it's obvious that naval mission over there represent only the extension of Soviet military, political, and economic doctrine. Once more affirming the interdependence of the three, in other words, military, politics, and economics. Also, there have been very little, if any, imitations in development of the Soviet Navy as in relation to the United States Navy. Moreover, the objectives of the Soviet states are such that only part of the naval weaponry development can be attributed to the United States action, as well as United States naval development. It's not necessarily interdependent, too. And more important is that all Soviet naval development, being part of a unified military doctrine and unified strategy, is tied closely to the overall political policy of the Soviet Union as a state. And only in the framework of this consideration, naval mission can be considered. Therefore, let me make a very short examination of broad international and more narrow naval pictures as Soviets themselves see them. Recent Soviet evaluation of the post-World War II development of international relations represents almost classical case of power politics. In spite of recognition of other than the military elements of power, military power still is viewed as not only a crucial, but often as a singular element, causing changes in the world balance of power, or, as the Soviets prefer to call it, the world correlation of force. Moreover, these changes are viewed as being imposed on the opponent. None or very little credit is given to the opponent's goodwill, rational behavior, or just common sense. Thus, the process of detente is viewed as being imposed upon the United States and Western Europe as a result of this changes in correlation of forces in favor of the Soviet Union. The changes, according to the Soviets, is the logical product of evolutionary and revolutionary processes, diminishing the power and influence of the capitalist system. Allegedly, this process is a product of bilateral phenomena. General crisis of capitalist system on the one hand, such as inflation, unemployment, instability of production, all of this in framework of almost perpetual economic and political crisis. And on the other hand, relative and uninterrupted growth and the development of the Soviet system. The Soviets have never claimed superiority, we have to recognize, either military or economic. What is stressed today is the trend. Militarily, compared with economics, the Soviets are even better. While nobody speaks, for example, of Soviet economic parity with the US, strategic parity, at least rhetorically, has been proclaimed while Soviet conventional superiority in some area is being claimed. Moreover, while for the Soviet parity, either real or just pronounced, represent a major achievement and a significant step forward, parity for the United States is exactly the reverse. A loss of predominance in the strategic and political fields with additional possibility of damage to self-confidence. Many events in the past two decades have encouraged Soviet belief that in general the theoretical prediction of Marxism-Leninism are working in spite of numerous shortcomings. In other words, colonial system has virtually disintegrated and disappeared. The influence of the Western countries in the Third World is considerably diminished. The economic growth and overall influence of socialist countries has been impressive. In essence, the world, I quote, correlation of forces has changed in favor of socialism. And there is no reason to doubt that they believe in this. Thus, the Soviet outlook for future is rather optimistic. It is highly unlikely that those international positions and trends obtained through the above mentioned progress will be abolished. Nor is the Soviet negotiating position likely to demonstrate much flexibility. For what? Why they should be flexible? Soviet long-range policy for the future has been determined and is the military distinguished as the military distinguishes between strategy and tactics. There are strategic and tactical elements in that policy. Being aware of the advantages which the image of a strong power generates in the world, and striving to appear co-equal with the United States, the Soviets have begun to use on an ever increasing scale the military element in support of their foreign policy. Today, Kremlin is definitely inclined to test new horizons of Soviet power, in which military element is an important factor. An examination of a recent pronouncement by Marshal Grechko clearly revealed the direction in which the Soviet military is moving and the roles reserved for it within the framework of Soviet foreign policy. And I have particularly in mind two works by Grechko, or two works which has his name. One appeared in May 1974 in magazine Question of History of CPSU, number 5, and was entitled, article, The Leading Role of the CPSU in Building the Army and Developing Socialist Society, of a Developed Socialist Society. And second is a book, which appeared in last year and entitled, Armed Forces of the Soviet State. In both works, Grechko emphasized economy, whose role, I quote, now increase even further. And he is quite open concerning the past and present role of the economy and build up of Soviet armed forces. He said that in the past, however, our opportunities and resources in this respect were limited, and the advantages of socialism could not be adequately displayed. Today, however, the changes which have taken place in the Soviet armed forces are so considerable that there is every justification for speaking on their new state and what this state is. He speaks about prerequisites which are being created for a new qualitative leap forward in the development of arms and combat equipment. But more important, he speaks about new and growing function of the Soviet armed forces. I quote, at the present stage, the historic purpose of the Soviet armed forces is not limited merely to their function in defending our motherland and the other socialist countries. In its foreign policy activity, the Soviet state actively and purposefully opposes the export of counter-revolution and the policy of oppression, supports the national liberation struggle, and resolutely resist imperialist aggression in whatever distant region of our planet it may appear. And I quote further, as a result, the external function of the Soviet state and its armed forces have now been enriched with new content. The development of external function of the socialist armies is a natural process. It will continue further. So thus, the Minister of Defense himself defined the role which is being planned for armed forces very clearly. I really admire Soviet frankness in formulation of their general goals. I do believe that they are not lying. Our only problem is that we often prefer to read between lines before we read lines themselves. Of course, what he refers to is that there is some new elements being added to the Soviet armed force and being developed. And of course, the main elements of these forces, which purpose to fulfill this so-called growing external function, would be general purpose forces, but particularly airborne troops and the Soviet Navy. Therefore, I would like to discuss briefly, in a more narrow sense, which I mentioned previously, how Commander-in-Chief of Soviet Navy, Gorshko, sees the changes. And I would make reference to the recent article by Admiral Gorshko, which appeared in number 12, December, issue of Morskoy Sbornik. Very interesting and very important article. Now, Gorshko in this article speaks about the revolution in military affairs, increasingly more rapid replacement of existing weapon systems, and the acceleration in the rate of development of the material base of war and of methods of force employment. Gorshko analyzed what he labeled individual components of the naval art, calling them categories. I should make a short excursus into Soviet military theory. I'm sure you know this, but I'd like to remind you that Soviet military theory, as a major component of it, has so-called military art. Correspondingly, there is naval art. However, military art is divided into three major parts. They are, from the top of importance, strategy, operational art, and tactics. Roughly equivalent in the United States terminology probably would be grand strategy, tactics. But I repeat, it's only rough, not exactly equivalent. So he, Gorshko, considers the changes in naval art. And this is very important because in the framework of naval art, there is no naval strategy, according to Soviet terminology and understanding. There is strategic use of the Soviet Navy, strategic employment of the Soviet Navy. There is naval art and there is naval tactics. Thus, once again, uniformity of strategy is confirmed. However, as we will see later, there are new elements in the development, and more Soviet Navy prefers to speak about something which is very closely related to the strategy. So Gorshko analyzes the changes in naval art and so-called its categories. These categories of the naval art are as follows: the scope of struggle, the strike, battle, maneuver, concentration, cooperation, tempo, control, etc., are said to be most effective and sensitive to changes in material means of armed struggle at sea. And I would like to make a brief examination how Gorshko sees these changes. Let's start from the beginning, the scope of the struggle. According to Gorshko, the constantly growing capabilities of navies to carry out strategic missions is elevating the role in warfare in general. The significance of the oceanic theaters of military operations is also being elevated accordingly. As a result, an even further increase in the scope of naval warfare as one of the most important parts of war as a whole is inevitable. Also, examining the struggle on a strategic level, Gorshko emphasized ever-growing capability of navies of great sea powers to achieve increasingly more decisive goals. The goals which will, I quote, affect not only the course, but even the outcome of nuclear war. And further, it is natural to summarize that the further development of Navy will allow them to wage an armed struggle on an even greater scale. In particular, the increased capabilities of strategic missile-carrying submarines to carry tasks of destruction of land targets will make it possible to expand the front and increase their depth of their strikes against enemy. In other words, clear hint that we have to expect longer range submarine launch missiles and increase their role in overall strategic delivery. Further, hence the corresponding growth of the spatial dimensions of operations against, I repeat, naval strategic nuclear weapons system is also quite clear. As a result, naval combat activity may embrace almost the entire expanse of world ocean and assume global character. Those of us who once entertained a thought that situations similar to ABM limitation may be applied in the future toward SLBM, if we would believe Gorshkov today, were wrong, because Gorshkov clearly refers not only to growing role of the nuclear ballistic missile submarine, but to necessity of corresponding increase in effort and capability to combat them. In other words, he is speaking here about ASW of strategic importance. In other words, not that tactical ASW, but ASW against ballistic missile submarine. Moreover, being a true scholar and student of Soviet military science, Gorshkov emphasized the increasing role that other groupings, rather groupings of other services of armed forces, will be participating in the operations in oceanic theater more than they do now. This is a very important factor because it is not, I believe, being fully understood by all students of Soviet military affairs. For many people, it is difficult to see how the smooth cooperation between, say, strategic missile troops, Soviet Navy, long-range aviation, or just Soviet Air Force, and even to, in certain occasions, Soviet ground forces can be achieved. But it is being practiced, and we shall expect more close cooperation of some, at least, services, particularly strategic missile troops and Soviet Air Force and Navy in the future. Next element or components of naval strike. According to Gorshkov, in future, the strike will become the main method of utilizing naval forces. It will be the solitary method of the strategic in the strategic field and will clearly retain and consolidate its role in operational arc. And on the tactical level, the strike will occupy a position equal in meaning to battle itself. In other words, we see the strike gaining more and more importance in the development of naval arc. Probably the feeling I think is completely justified. Next, he considered battle. This form of action, according to Gorshkov, combining power, fire, and maneuver, has always been and will remain the main method of carrying out tactical missions. In the future, the effective ranges of naval weaponry will increase even further. Therefore, a naval battle will range over vast areas, and the coverage of the situation in the region of the battle will become possible only with the aid of specialized, primarily airborne means. If we think about it, we will see the role of helicopters aboard of new Soviet ships, and to a certain degree, a role for future airborne means of Kiev in this description of battle by Gorshkov. Moreover, a third future of the battle is the ever-growing importance of destroying or diverting from a given trajectory of the enemy means of destruction. In other words, being this torpedo or missiles, before they reach their targets. And he also emphasized that a naval battle is always was waged to destroy the enemy. And today, this requirement is even stronger. So here we see two parts. A, he doesn't speak about some damaging action or just putting out of commission temporarily some major ships, but he speaks about necessity to destroy. Second, he doesn't speak about damage control as much in the battle, but about necessity to have capability, anti-missile capability of their navy. The trend clearly evident since about second half of the 60s. The Soviets gradually started to acquire this anti-cruise missile capability on the board of their ships. This is the meaning of the sound developed of their missiles, SAMs, and particularly the more classical means of destruction of the flying this automatic guns and the means you're clearly familiar with. The next category is maneuver. According to Gorshkov, maneuver in battle is executed on the tactical deployment level, is decreasing linearly with respect to the increase in the effectiveness of range of weapons. Well, this means very simple. He tries to tell us, and he is telling us, that maneuvers of forces, which previously played such important role, is being gradually replaced in importance by maneuver of trajectories. And the longer the ranges of weaponry, the greater opportunity for maneuvers of trajectory exists. And hence, diminishing importance of maneuvers by platforms themselves, or carriers of the systems, weapon systems, which is rather old, about 15, 20 years, Soviet understanding of maneuver. Concentration is also been modified because of longer ranges of trajectories, or long range of weaponry, and possibility to maneuver of trajectories. Now there is no such urgent need to concentrate forces in order to concentrate the strike. The strike can be concentrated by two factors. One, simple concentration of trajectory on one target, and yield of individual weapons. And he speaks about both tendency being developed in the naval warfare. Cooperation. He has some reservations concerning the old understanding of cooperation. And moreover, emphasized already expressed idea expressed by Admiral Platonov. No, I'm sorry, Admiral Pantileev, about 8 years ago, that while cooperation is helpful on tactical level, essential, desirable on operational level, and essential on strategic level, often this action of the forces should not be restricted for the sake of achieving cooperation. An idea, nobody wait for anybody, has been prevailing idea. In spite of the fact that cooperation is still recognized. Surprise. Well, naturally, with the presence of nuclear weaponry, element of surprise is given due importance, and nothing new is being said by Admiral Gorshkov in this respect. The same as in swiftness of operation and the tempo. control. In control, great emphasis is made on the automation. Again, the theme which can be spotted for the last 7-8 years in the Soviet writings concerning the Navy. And he concludes, I try to be short, that the development of naval art is related to the affirmation of all of its traditional categories under new quality criteria. And it's understandable why he emphasizes new quality criteria, because in spite of the fact that almost all old categories are present in a new naval art, they undergo considerable changes, some of them not only of evolutionary, but rather revolutionary nature. Now, let me briefly conclude on mission itself. Well, I have to start with, again, Admiral Gorshkov, because I think he is an authority on the Soviet Navy, and we can't ignore him. And you are familiar with his division of missions into two major categories. The first category, according to him, common to all great powers, navies and include: A, participating in strategic nuclear for strike; B, weakening enemy ocean-launched nuclear strikes; and C, participating in operations conducted in the continental theater. And second category, according to Gorshkov, is the protection of the interests of the Soviet Union and other socialist countries. These are missions. Well, we can tailor this broad definition of Gorshkov into more familiar, probably, categories, and they again will be deterrence and strategic delivery, as a third. Second, weakening of enemy ocean launch strike might be seen as an anti-strategic missile submarine action, which Gorshkov clearly refers to. Anti-carrier capability in action, which still exists, and properly so, because they cannot ignore it. And a third, anti-general purpose naval forces action of Soviet Navy, which tied to the third mission, if we can, participation operation of in operations conducted on the continental theaters of warfare. It's a very broad, really very broad mission of the Soviet Navy, and many things can be understood. In analyzing Gorshkov's writings on the navies in war and peace, many speculations were made concerning this type of mission, but basically, I think all possible warfare between NATO and Warsaw Pact would fall in this category, at least initial, nothing excluding even SLAC. Interdiction, in spite of the fact that many people prefer not to speak about it, cannot be ignored from a list of possible Soviet naval missions. And not because the United States probably will not have neither time nor maybe forces to conduct classical bridge between the United States continent and the American continent and Europe, but because there are other forms of supply primarily needed to the United States itself. I am not so sure that, in spite of the claims that Soviet Navy is built for a short war, for primarily nuclear war, the war will be either short or necessarily nuclear. It might be a mixture, it might be a rather prolonged duration. If one examines the very limited writings available on the Soviet principles of targeting, one was surprised to find out that their specialists are not being satisfied with the first, not the first, but with initial destructive strike. And they plan and visualize later repeated strikes in order to, and I quote, prevent enemy from rebuilding its war potential, or preventing from organizing war production. And if we accept this, and there is no reason to believe that this might be the case under certain circumstances, we see the role of C-communication under these circumstances will be crucial. And Soviet just cannot afford to ignore the interdiction campaign or our old SLAC communication, SLAC operation, anti-SLAC operation. So I'm not so sure that this old and familiar form of naval action and mission should be ignored under present conditions. I believe the situation which existed, say, in mid-60s, might not necessarily exist in the second half of 70s. And we might think about this more seriously than we do. And of course, the last one again is the protection of state interests. This is very interesting new mission, which we briefly talk about. But what is emphasized here is, again, the decisive imperialist action against the movement of national liberation, independence, and progress, and so on, and by definition, a necessity of Soviet counteraction, the counteraction. And this, I believe, is the main point. And in this case, the protecting of Soviet, the interests of the Soviet state is what I term, I don't know, rightly or wrongly, is a Soviet mission which can be said as just selective containment of the United States Navy in the condition of peacetime, not wartime, but peacetime. Because, with exception of, if we remove the United States Navy, there is really no serious opponent exists today for Soviet Navy. And this is why, oversimplifying this very broad, very complex mission, I prefer to call it as a containment of the United States Navy. Thus it can be concluded that, again, missions of Soviet Navy, their tasks, and I look at the definition given by Joint Chiefs of Staff Dictionary, there is really not great difference between missions and tasks according to the mission, should be viewed in the framework of overall Soviet policy. Moreover, I like to emphasize once more the necessity to tie together Soviet policy, their military doctrine, their economic doctrine, because Soviets do not view Navy as being something isolated, neither from their armed forces nor from the state. It's only a part of the system and should function as such. In this framework, if we will examine the possible Soviet Navy missions, we have better chance to be closer to the truth, although there is no guarantee for errors, than otherwise trying to assign missions similar to those claimed for the United States Navy. Well, thank you very much. I'm ready for your questions.